Yes, it's time for another episode of Sacred Cinema with me, your host, Jimmy Bernasconi on 2XXFM, People Powered Radio. And if you're going to stick around with us for the next half hour, we're going to be chatting films that depict young love. So why young love? I mean, we've all experienced it. There's so many films about it. I guess this is sort of getting into the coming of age subgenre of cinema as well. Well, last week, if you were with us last week, we talked about Beauties and Beasts, films that depict that dynamic relationship where you have a female character at the center of your film or your center of your story who is coming to terms with or confronting some alter ego or some counterpart of hers that has a beastly quality to it. And we did get into some pretty sexual territory. I mean, I think it's pretty fair to say that there are definitely some sexual innuendos that are implied in films like that. And we did dive into that to quite an extent last week. And I sort of started thinking about that element of, you know, how is sex depicted in cinema? How has that changed over the years? And I thought, well, I think we should do a show about that. I think it's obviously one of the pillars of existence, you know, our relationship with sex and our sexual relationships with other people. But the more you think about it, there's just so many films that go into that sort of thing. So I thought we'd break it up a little bit. And we'd specifically focus on, because I started looking up all these different films that explore the idea and went back and watched a couple of favorites of mine that deal with this sort of stuff. And then I realized that there's one sort of subsection within the sexual cinema, I suppose is what you'd call it. That I think is really interesting, really thought-provoking. And there's some really interesting coincidences and connections between a lot of films that dive into this sort of territory. So we're going to focus on young love or young sex. Encountering sex as a youngster, specifically as a teenager, and how cinema deals with that and in what ways is it depicted. I mean, obviously, we could be talking about things like American Pie, Beta House, that sort of thing, but we're talking about some serious movies today, okay? So don't get too excited. We're going to be talking about high school flicks. But it is interesting how some of the films actually subvert some of those norms or play with them or make them deal with them in a much more serious or sincere sense. But before we get into the films themselves, we always like to have a look at, you know, how has this topic that we've chosen for today's conversation been explored or conveyed or depicted throughout cultural history, throughout the literature, perhaps in the major religions. The first thing that for me that comes to mind if we're talking about young love between two youngsters, the first story that I think has endured through the years about this is probably Romeo and Juliet. I'm sure we've all studied that one in high school. Obviously, you've got the Zeffirelli film. I believe that was in 1968, I think. And then you've also got, of course, the Baz Luhrmann film as well. We're not going to talk about that one this week because, I mean, I think we could talk about that another week, I think. But I think it's definitely worth a mention. And particularly, I wanted to specifically emphasize the fact that as much as that's a beloved story, you know, in the Western canon, and we perhaps have, when we reflect on Romeo and Juliet, we have maybe like positive memories, or there are certain scenes that stick out to be quite romantic, perhaps maybe one of the most romantic stories of all time. But it is a tragedy nonetheless, and Shakespeare didn't just write, tragedies. He wrote comedies. I suppose he could have made it a comedy, or he could have written a play about young love that is a comedy. But we have to remember that does end, maybe has one of the most tragic ends in all of the, you know, Western literature. And then we can move on as well to some of the major religions and things like that. I mean, I don't think there are many religions that advocate for children engaging in sexual activity, right? It's clearly something that in modern society we don't particularly advocate for. And in fact, people that do engage in that sort of thing are very often, you know, the bottom of the barrel in terms of members of our society. And I suppose religion has things like no sex before marriage, which is perhaps a way that it instills those norms in a way. I mean, Christianity specifically, but I believe a lot of religions throughout the world and throughout history have demanded that of its adherents. So it doesn't look good. It doesn't look good for young love, I suppose. And when I say young love, I suppose I mean sex. But engaging in some pretty deep emotional relationships with another, it seems like it's something that you actually need to mature in order to succeed in executing it. But we'll park that for just a moment, and we'll get into the films and see what they have to say before we get ahead of ourselves. So what are the films, you may be asking? Well, the first film we're going to talk about is an English film directed by Andrea Arnold. Of course, we're talking about Fish Tank from 2009. We're then going to move on to a very small independent American film. You may not have heard of this one. It was directed, though, by Eliza Hittman, who you may know from the recent film Never Really, Sometimes Always, which explores some of the deeper issues surrounding the abortion question. That one is going to be It Felt Like Love from 2013. That's going to be the second film we talk about. And then we're going to finally move on to our third and final film, which is directed by one of my favorites. We have talked about him before on the show. That would be Eric Rohmer's 1983 film, Pauline at the Beach. Now, if you're a massive cinephile, you may realize that there is a massive connection between all three of these films. They are all, of course, about young love. Yes, that's right. But they all center on the stories of 15-year-old girls. So all of our protagonists in today's films are 15-year-old girls. I don't know how that narrows or broadens today's conversation. I couldn't entitle it 15-year-old girls and then, you know, proceed. That would be a weird title. So maybe this is a some of the lessons or insights that we're going to discuss today are specific to femininity or womanhood or young womanhood or specifically to 15-year-olds. I'm not really sure. I've never been a 15-year-old girl. I don't plan on it. I don't think it's possible for me at this stage, being a 26-year-old man. But we'll give it a go for the sake of today's conversation. And if you have any thoughts on it, if you think that maybe there are some deeper insights that we could add to today's discussion, please get in contact with the show. As always, you can find us on Facebook by searching Sacred Cinema with Jimmy Bernasconi. But let's move on to the first film for today's discussion. And that would be Andrea Arnold's 2009 film, Fish Tank. So, if you haven't seen this one, it was a pretty big hit when it came out. I believe it won some jury prizes at the Cannes Film Festival. But basically, it centers on Mia, who is living in a pretty dingy unit with her mum and little sister. She's probably in maybe one of the lower socioeconomic classes in Britain where she lives. And I think it's pretty clear from the title of this film. Of course, it's entitled Fish Tank. We're definitely dealing with some themes of feeling trapped or feeling imprisoned. And I think that's very much carried not only through the title of the film. I think the title is really interesting as well. It's not called prison or trap. It's called fish tank. You know, what is a fish tank? We can look into a fish tank, right? We can see what's inside. The things inside can't come out, obviously. But we can see them inside. But we can't really do anything about it, can we? We can't really put our hands through the glass. There seems to be this massive force field. So I think that's some interesting imagery just to start the film off. And I actually love how this film starts as well. It just gives us the title on the very first shot. So when exactly we are dealing with the film Fish Tank here, that's going to stay with you for the entirety of the film. So it's an interesting title there to start off with. And this motif of animals being enclosed continues throughout the film. We get some close-up shots of a gerbil at one point, which did remind me of the film, the Denis Villeneuve film, Prisoners, where I think it's like a weasel or a rat, or it might even be another gerbil or hamster that's in the girls, if you haven't seen the film, it's about some little girls that get abducted by Paul Dano and Melissa Leo. And at the beginning of the film, this feeling of being imprisoned begins with this little shot of a little rodent in a cage, and it's I suppose foreshadowing what's about to happen to the little girls in the movie. And we see a similar shot in this film with in the little girl's room and Mia's little sister's room, this gerbil being trapped inside this cage. And there also is a scene where they go into an actual river stream and they catch a fish with their bare hands. But we might just park that for just a moment. There is another sequence at the beginning of the film as well, where Mia is sort of trying to get hold of someone. She's chasing after someone, and she's trying to get through all these doors, and she's having a lot of trouble with it. And I think that's a really interesting metaphor for the film, that there are these perceived gateways around her, right? There are these perceived doorways or links to new realms, links to new areas, but there's a lot of difficulty, and it's a frustrating sense of difficulty difficulty that she has in trying to penetrate through these doorways and break free into a, you know, a more liberated setting and that sort of thing. But getting back to that thing we said about the fish, I think it's a really important plot point. I think it's really key to today's conversation as well, because we see a lot of similarities in the two other films we're going to talk about today. But there's a scene where Mia and her mum and her little sister are taken to this river by Michael Fassbender's character, who is actually dating Mia's mother in this film. And he wades out into the middle of the river to go catch a fish, and Mia goes to follow him. And she, as she's doing that, she obviously has to take her shoes off to go into the river, and she cuts her foot, and there's this bloody cut on her foot, and she has that, you know, through this whole scene, and she gets out of the river eventually, and it's still bleeding and that sort of thing. And that this seems to be, obviously it's almost like a bit of a scar that endures throughout the rest of the film. And I think that serves as a nice little metaphor as well for another aspect of her situation. Not only is she feeling trapped, but she also doesn't know where she's going, right? It's one thing to understand your surroundings, and I guess this does go back to the fish tank idea about it. Does a fish know it's trapped, or does a fish have any perception of how to get out of the tank? In this sense, Mia is a bit of a fish herself, that she's sort of wading through these dark waters all the while she's trying to look for a way out. She's wading through these dark waters, really no idea what's going on, and I think that's a really good way of symbolizing her sense of naivety, and I think that's going to be a major theme in today's conversation, which will lift up a lot throughout today's discussions. So she's feeling trapped, and so I suppose when someone feels trapped, they want to find ways of breaking free. But one of the big challenges for me is perceiving the right or the appropriate means of liberating herself. Now, what I love about this film, this is probably the aspect of the film that I think is so refreshing to watch, is that in dealing with someone that's living in a low socioeconomic status, and I should say that I'm not someone that lives in a low socioeconomic status, I haven't really had much experience with that in my life, but I think so often films do this very pessimistic or dire thing where they make it out that there's absolutely no way or no possible or tangible opportunity or capacity or chance of our protagonist being able to break free, and saying that it's completely the system itself that's imprisoning of this person. Now, I'm not saying that it's not the system or that it's not nature itself, but it is wrong to think that in Mia's situation or to look at Mia's situation and think that there is no way out for her, right? What I love is the fact that it's what's more important is whether she could perceive that there is a way out. And when we're with her for the entirety of this film, it doesn't really matter when these opportunities arise. But by being so empathetic with her, by being empathetic of her, or, and being with her every step of the way of her journey, we have so much sympathy. But we can really see how she isn't able to bring herself out of this situation, even though some of these opportunities do arise. So the obvious one is when she's offered a position, a spot at a school. That's nice. I think it's like a private school or something like that. Out of the way, and a social worker comes to her house to talk about that, and she rips up the letter and everything, and we can feel that with her, right? Even though that's obviously the best thing that she can do, we don't see her as some kind of spoiled brat at all. It reminds me a little bit of that conversation we had about Requiem for a Dream a couple of weeks ago, where we talk about it doesn't really matter even if it is the person's fault. They can still be a victim, or we can still perceive them to be a victim if, when we're standing in their shoes, we can see why they're not pursuing the opportunities that might be better for them. They can't perceive what's good for them. They're wading through the dark waters. To me, she's a 15-year-old girl. She thinks that dancing is the way that she's going to break free out of this. And we see this tragic scene where she finds this leaflet, this pamphlet for dancing auditions, and we know that obviously this is for something that's perhaps a little bit adult, and there's a bit of a gap in the film which I love, that between her finding this pamphlet and a bunch of things happening and her feeling like, well, this is all fine because I'm eventually going to be a professional dancer, and then she eventually goes to this audition that's obviously for dancing at a strip club. So again, this is a misperception of a new gateway, but the ultimate false gateway is Michael Fassbender's character, who she develops a bit of a crush on, and he gives her sister and her money every now and then, and he likes to play with them, and he obviously took, as I mentioned before, takes them out of the river and things like that. So he sort of has this I'm not going to say sugar daddy, but he has the aura of someone who's potentially going to provide opportunity, and probably the most confronting scene of the film is that in which he I guess he sexually assaults her because she's a 15-year-old girl. She can't consent to what's going on. But in her eyes, she's falling in love. And she's eventually, she feels in this moment that she's finally getting her key or her ticket out of here, and she's going to run away. And for the final act of this film, it is pretty turbulent. It's some pretty serious viewing. And it really does lift up how tragic her circumstances are, that she pursues that this sexual encounter with Michael Fassbender's character as this false gateway for liberation. And I think that that's probably the major theme that I want to bring up at this point in today's discussion, is the idea that love or sex at that age, as a teenager, can have this, it's almost like a false prophecy. It can have this quality of looking like liberation, looking like a ticket to freedom, when it's quite the opposite, and really just entrenches someone further in a sense of social imprisonment. But that's not the only aspect I want to talk about today in terms of why we engage in potentially quite immature sexual acts as young people. And at this point, I'd like to move on to our next film for today's discussions, which is Eliza Hittman's 2013 film, It Felt Like Love. Now, as I mentioned earlier, you may not have heard this film before, had a pretty limited release, isn't very well known, but obviously Eliza Hittman has gained some notoriety in recent years, so a lot of her earlier work has gained a little bit more presence online and on the streaming services and that sort of thing. I think you can access this one on Mubi, or at least that's how I watched it. But if you don't know much about the film, if you haven't seen it before, this one centers on the character of Lila. Now, she's living in Brooklyn. We open with her and her friends out on a beach, and she's got all this sunscreen on her face. She's clearly a child. She looks a lot younger than Mia does in Fish Tank, but they are the same age. And she's sort of going through the motions of being a teenage girl. Now, on paper, if you read the plot of this film, or at least the first two acts of the film, you'd probably get the impression that it's just a classic coming-of-age film. And I think that's why it's got such a low rating on IMDb, is because I think a lot of people approach it thinking it's going to be, you know, something like, I don't know, like Paper, what's that Paper Towns, or what's the one with Emma Watson in it, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, like something like that. It's about a young girl coming to terms with her, you know, developing body and sex and boys and that sort of thing. And all those things happen. You know, she has her first drink, and she goes to a party, and she has to deal with, you know, her sexual desires and that sort of thing. But it's all those things in a much more realistic, and it's almost like bleakly realistic. It's raw is probably the best way to put it, in engaging in all that stuff. And she has a best friend who's got her first boyfriend, and they're kissing all the time in front of her. And she starts to become jealous of her, and in that classic teenager way, starts to adopt a lot of her mannerisms, starts using the same sexual language as she does around her other people in her life, and she even dyes her hair the same as her friend. Her friend's name is Kiara, by the way. And as Kiara starts to develop sexually herself, Lila wants to follow that and tracks down this man named Sammy, who's a bit older. I think he's like 21 or something like that. And he's a bit of a thuggy kind of guy, a bit of a gangster kind of guy, wears singlets, bit of a tough guy with a shaved head. And at some point, Kiara says to Lila that she knows this guy because he lives in her neighborhood, and he has sex with a lot of the girls in the neighborhood. And Lila sort of sees him as her first target. And I should say, in talking this back, you know, in talking about this film, I really do recommend actually going and sitting down and watching this film, because it is so much more confronting when you sit down and actually watch a baby-faced, very skinny, very innocent young girl deal with this sort of stuff. And when we talk about it, we maybe have images of her being quite, you know, mature and on top of things, but she really is a little girl in this movie. It's extremely confronting throughout the entire film, and I think it is a really good film for that reason, actually. And to further accentuate this guy, Sammy, how much older or how much more of a danger he might be to Lila, we compare him to the other character of Nate, which is a little boy that lives next to Lila. They're about the same age, and he kisses this girl that comes over to his house and things like that, but he's not doing anything overly adult. So that's his character, his presence sort of accentuates how much older Sammy is and how potentially dangerous he might be for Lila. Now, at this point, I'd like to talk about another scene in which a character goes walking through a body of water and cuts their foot. Just like in Fish Tank, we have the same symbol in It Felt Like Love. And I think obviously It Felt Like Love is very much influenced by Fish Tank. There's a lot of dancing imagery in this one as well. Both films remind me a lot of the Pablo Larraín film Emma that we talked about a couple of weeks ago as well. So I think you could watch all three of these films together and they would work really nicely. But in this film, it's actually the guy that steps on the foot. And I think that's really interesting if we... that cuts his foot while walking through the river. And I think that's really interesting because it sort of says that not only are these female figures innocent and naive and walking through these dark waters, not really knowing where they're going or what they're doing, but also the men in their lives that are potentially the ones that are potentially going to cause all this harm that inevitably occurs are also walking through blindly, right? Even though they may present themselves as mature men who know what they're doing and can take care of a woman, they too are pretty aimless. Pretty unaware of how to conduct themselves in society, which I suppose makes them all the more dangerous because who knows what they might think is okay. And as the film progresses, we see the relationship between Lila and Sammy get more and more serious to a point that is I'll put it this way, it's quite serious at least for this point in the conversation. To compare It Felt Like Love and Fish Tank one step further, I'd just like to mention that when we're watching Fish Tank, we kind of understand why Mia is doing a lot of the things she's doing because she's coming from a pretty low socioeconomic status. It's pretty understandable why she is the way she is. But in It Felt Like Love, there's a little bit of mystery around why Lila is like that. I mean, not every 15-year-old girl is running around looking for guys to sleep with. Obviously, it is quite common, and that's why these films are made. But there seems to be something deeper going on, and it is revealed later in the film, and I don't mean to... if you haven't seen the film and you really want to watch it, I would suggest you you stop, you don't listen to the next bit because it does sort of give away a lot about her characterization. But it turns out that Lila's mother has actually deceased. And so that's lifting up this idea that with the deficiency in having a deficiency in our sense of companionship, in our sense of connection with the people that we love, there can be a bit of a tilting of the scales in a way where we try and make up for that deficiency by throwing ourselves or going into overdrive in terms of our relationships in other aspects of our life. It's almost to say that she's going after this guy Sammy and men like him to make up for the lack of companionship that she has in losing her mother. Right? It's like a seesaw that there are these sliding scales in a way, and that is realized in the climax of this film, which is very graphic. And I should give a bit of a warning that it is extremely confronting scene where Sammy is sitting around with a couple of his friends in this den that he lives in, and Lila has come over again to chill out with the boys and try and impress them, and they ask her if she wants to perform fellatio on all three of them, and they proceed to stand up each one of them and drop their pants and present their genitals to her. And in that moment, it's almost like a horror film that we're sitting there going, oh my goodness, this poor girl who's lost her mother, that's so aimless, that has no idea what she's doing, is confronted with this overly serious, quite a severe and harsh moment in her development. So we kind of leave this film feeling that there is a real concern or a real danger that when we lose our sense of compassion with or companionship with the people that should really be our close ones, our nearest and dearest when we're 15. If we lose those people, if we lack that connection, we're going to look for it somewhere else, or at least there's the danger of that happening. And if we don't have the normal structures in place, we can really do ourselves some harm and be really put in a place of serious danger. But let's move on to the third and final film for today's discussions. Because at this point, I've kind of given a bit of a scathing critique of youngsters, right? We've talked about how naive young people can be in the world of love. But is it something that's exclusive to young people? Is it reserved for teenagers themselves? And at this point, I think it's worth bringing up Eric Rohmer's 1983 film, Pauline at the Beach, which, if you haven't seen it, it's about a young girl called Pauline who lives in France and goes off with her cousin, Marion, I hope I've said that correctly, to this beach town in France. And they sort of both fall in love with different guys, or they get involved with different guys. And throughout the film, it's sort of like a comparison between how they both deal with love. Now, this film sort of subverts what we've been talking about for the last half hour, right? It turns out that Pauline, who's the 15-year-old in this film, is actually much more careful in love than her older cousin. She looks to meet someone before she gets involved and really wants to get to know someone, to be their friend at first, rather than diving into a deep connection with them. Whereas Marion, who has actually been married and divorced throughout her life, is a very sexy, slender, blonde-haired, Well, she's literally referred to as a bimbo at one point in the film, but she's a little bit more sophisticated than that. But she does fall in love very easily, and is sort of the is targeted by let's say more superficial men, or men who are interested in having sort of a quick and easier relationship rather than something serious. So we're subverting that idea that by being young, you're immediately thrown into a dangerous relationship, whereas the older character in this film is the one that's actually doing that. Now, I think there's a couple of instances in this film where we see that realized in a more profound way. The first instance of that would be, I would say, in the relationship that Marion and Pauline have with this fellow, Henri, who is the man that Marion mostly sleeps with throughout this film. And he's about like 40 or 50. He's balding. He's this older sort of bourgeois type guy. He's an ethnographer that lives in the South Pacific. And he sort of gets involved with Marion. But as when she goes off to Paris later in the film, he actually has a crack at Pauline as well, who's a 15-year-old girl, and she turns him away. So that's a pretty clear comparison of how they both interact around the same kind of guy, that Marion is much more likely to engage with that guy. And that's not just because she's an adult and she's older. I mean, this guy isn't a particularly good guy. I mean, he cheats on her throughout the film. He's a bit of a cad. He's a bit of a chauvinist. He's a bit of a womanizer. And Pauline can perceive that is something that he is, and while Marion can't. There's another aspect of this film I thought is quite relevant to today's discussion, specifically in 2021, we have this other character named Pierre, who's quite interested in Marion. He's 30 or something as well, and Marion actually tries to get him and Pauline together. She has no problems with seeing her younger cousin engage in what we would now consider to be a pretty inappropriate, or at the very least precarious, relationship between someone who is way too old for Pauline. But I think the best scene that depicts the kind of relations that Pauline and Marion have with men is the scene in which Marion comes into Henri's house while he's cheating on her, and he hides the girl he's cheating on her with in a bathroom, and she comes up the stairs and she sees that there's someone in the bathroom, and he says to her, no, she's just here with another guy, she's not with me. And for the rest of the film, Marion goes on assuming that she's not being cheated on, all the while Pauline, it's important to mention as well that this girl that Henri has been cheating on with, he's in the house with him, is Pauline's boyfriend this entire time as well. So he tells Marion that those two got together, Pauline's boyfriend and this girl. So Marion tells Pauline that her boyfriend's been cheating on her. Anyway, all you need to know for the sake of the film is that Marion tells Pauline that her boyfriend cheated on her, all the while Pauline knows that what actually happened was Marion got cheated, who was cheated on. Anyway, the film ends, in the final scene of the film, it's not only that Marion gets cheated on, right? It's not just that she turns a blind eye to what's actually happened, but she actively advocates for Pauline to turn a blind eye to what might have happened, and that she will do the same. As her older cousin, she says, "The advice I would give you is to continue living your life with the thought that nothing bad happened to you, that you didn't get cheated on, and I will do the same." Even those two things can't both mutually exist in the same universe, in the same dimension. That's what we're going to do because it'll make us feel better. And I suppose that's an interesting place to finish today's discussion, right? When discussing the first two films, we talked about the idea that love can be a very dangerous game because we may misperceive it to be a means of freedom or companionship or the kind of companionship that we require to live a stable and emotionally stable life. But what's really important to remember is that our propensity or our vulnerability in being hurt in love, in being harmed in love and sexual relationships is not something that we just mature out of naturally. It's not something that goes away when you get older. In fact, unless you employ some kind of deliberate actions or deliberate behaviors, we can be just as immature or just as vulnerable or just as naive as a 35 or 45 or 55 year old as we were when we were 15. Well, that's Sacred Cinema for this week. I've been your host, Jimmy Bernasconi. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.